And Lieutenant Colonel retired Kevin Randall with us as we talk about some UFO cases. We've got a whole bunch of them, and your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Kevin Randall. Of course, we'll get to your calls, too, on Coast to Coast AM. Kevin, did you know the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek?
Yes, I did.
What'd you think of him?
Incredibly intelligent man who looked at the evidence, went where the evidence took him, and although he started out as a skeptic and an Air Force consultant, as he investigated the cases and learned what was going on, came around to the idea that there was alien visitation.
His change of heart was dramatic, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, at one point he was on the side of the Air Force and was offering sort of shoot from the hip explanations from UFO sightings, but then he looked at the evidence. He was convinced by the evidence that there's something truly was going on and deserved a better investigation than it was getting by the Air Force.
They had other investigators out there too, the great late Frank Edwards and people like that. I miss all those people.
There was a time where the Lorenzens did an awful lot to bring UFOs to the mainstream. Don Kehoe with his research and his connections into the Pentagon and military.
And he put together NICAP, remember?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And Dick Hall, let's not forget Dick Hall, who also is responsible for an awful lot of good UFO research and work.
And our old buddy Stanton Friedman, still kicking.
Absolutely, absolutely. Although I think he slowed down a tad bit, but just a tad.
Yeah, but for him, his slowing down is what other people work at peak capacity, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
He's one of a kind. He was my first radio interview when I was 21, Kevin.
Oh, my Lord.
He was in Detroit. He was speaking before some engineers and at a college. And I saw a little clip in the Detroit News, the paper, and I asked my news director, I said, I want to go cover this UFO guy. And he went, no, you can't do that. And I said, no. He said, I'm not going to pay the overtime for that. And I said, I'm going to do it on my own. And I did. Who would
know? Sometimes that's just what you have to do.
Yep. And then years later, you know, he ended up being on my local show in St. Louis. And then Coast to Coast, he's one of a guy. He had a little heart attack about a year ago, but
yes, that's why I said he was slowing down a tad bit.
Yep, he is bounced back. Of all these cases that you've looked at, which is that one single case, Kevin, that just blows your mind?
Well, ignoring Roswell.
Right.
I think the Levelland sightings from November of 1957, you have witnesses at 13 separate locations seeing an object that's interacting with the environment, stalling car engines, causing lights to fade out. There is evidence that there was a landing trace that was sort of overlooked at the time. But here's a case where you've got all these people independently reporting basically the same thing in a period of 90 minutes or 2 hours around the Levelland. And then you advance the clock by an hour, 2 hours, and the things are going on at White Sands Missile Range over the next 12 to 14 hours. So you link all that case together. That's the one that really sticks out to me, that had we not been so busy arguing over the number of witnesses. Kehoe said there was 9 witnesses. The Air Force says, there's only 3. Kehoe's making this stuff up. Well, the number of witnesses didn't matter, and they were both wrong because there's witnesses at 13 separate locations that I could find based on the Air Force files, if nothing else. That's the case that was really, really exciting. The Condon Committee, when they investigated UFOs, they had a report of a car being stalled by a UFO, and so they went out and they magnetically mapped the car.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got some similar cars and mapped it and said, well, there's no significant difference in the magnetic signatures of these cars. Therefore, she didn't see the UFO, and therefore it did not affect their car. And this is the only reference they make to the Levelland case. It disproves the Levelland case. And I'm thinking, how? does it disprove the Leveland case? You do one investigation of one car.
Yeah.
It doesn't give you any real results, so you dismiss the Leveland cases. You don't even bother to talk to witnesses. And it's a case that was only 10 years old. The witnesses were all easily available. There was a lot of things they could have done in 1967 when they started their investigation, but they just ignored that case.
Well, and I'm convinced the Condon report was set up as a sham.
When I did the government UFO files and looked at all of that sort of thing, the documentation is there to prove that point precisely. Condon was at a lecture in Corning, New York, I think it was, 18 months prior to the end of the investigation, and he said to the engineers there, I'm ready to conclude there's really nothing to this right now, but I'm not supposed to come to that conclusion for another 18 months. That's reported in the newspapers.
Unbelievable. And University of Colorado, I think he was from, wasn't he?
Yes, and at the time the Condon Committee was being organized, I was in high school in Denver, and so a friend of mine, Eric Novotny, and I were extremely excited about the Condon Committee and the University of Colorado doing the research until we discovered what exactly was going on and that it really wasn't going to be an investigation. But he actually solved the case by saying it was a natural phenomenon so rare it had never been seen before or since. And their conclusion was that there was nothing of scientific value to the continued study of UFOs. And I'm thinking, if you've got a natural phenomenon that rare, that maybe there is something of scientific value you could learn by learning what that natural phenomenon is rather than ignoring it and using this preposterous explanation for a UFO sighting.
I was in Michigan, Kevin, when Dr. Hynek came there in Dexter, Michigan, and talked about swamp gas. And boy, that haunted him.
I've always thought that he got a bad rap on that, and here's why. I don't know if he had been to Michigan before he made that statement, but what I understood was somebody asked him off the cuff, well, these sightings going on in Michigan in this area, and you know, the lights in the distance. And he said, well, it sounds like swamp gas to me.
Right.
And, of course, the media all said, oh, well, there's the explanation. Hynek hadn't talked to a witness, hadn't been there, but he just made this off-the-cuff comment about it sounded like swamp gas. And so I always thought he got a bad rap on that one. But that also was sort of the beginning of the turning point for him as well, as he began to look at the way the Air Force was conducting their investigation. And if you take a look at the Air Force investigation of Project Blue Book, well, Project Sun, actually, you know, my mind is now motoring at 4 o'clock in the morning. in the government UFO files, I talk about the first unofficial UFO investigation, and it started in December of 1946, 6 months before the Arnold sighting in June of 1947, and before there was an official investigation. But Howard McCoy was an air intelligence officer involved in investigating the Foo Fighters during World War II, involved in investigating the ghost rockets in 1946, and suddenly in December of 1946, he is now involved in a UFO investigation, unofficially. And all that data has disappeared. There's hints of it in the Project Blue Book files. There's hints of this stuff, but there's not a lot of information. But we can show that the modern era of UFOs actually began with the Foo Fighters, not with Arnold in 1947. But we can show an interest by the United States military, starting with the Foo Fighters, going through the ghost rockets, going up until the Arnold sighting, and then we get the Twining letter of September saying, yeah, this is something real and not illusionary and fictitious, and we got to find out what it is.
What was it, so, Kevin? I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, it just sort of links all this together, and the link is Howard McCoy being involved in all this, because the Twining letter was actually authored by McCoy for Twining's signature. So you've got McCoy involved in all of this stuff. So here's the guy that links all the UFO sightings, the flying saucers, the flying discs, the Foo Fighters, the ghost rockets, links all that stuff together as the beginning of the investigations in the early 1940s.
What was it that caused Hynek to finally change his mind and really become a supporter and believer?
I think it was looking at the evidence, looking at the witness testimonies that he was seeing, and looking at how the some of those testimonies was being ignored by the Air Force. There's a case from, I think it's 1957, during that sign, and the witness is an Air Force officer. She's an Air Force reservist. So that when the Air Force investigates it, they just grind this guy into the ground. They say, oh, he's a reservist. He was going off active duty. He's about to go to Hollywood to become a writer, so he's probably making this story up so that he can get a good job in Hollywood. No evidence that ever happened, but they throw this guy to the wolves because they don't like his sighting, and it's going to be, well, an Air Force officer said that he saw a UFO and he saw the creatures from it or it stalled his car. And so you look at all of that stuff, and you can see what they're doing. It's not investigating UFOs. It is to convince people there's nothing to it. And they did a very good job of that.
Yeah, they sure do.
But it was those sorts of cases that I think Hynek was looking at and seeing the way things were going that made him decide that there was something more to it, and it deserved a good scientific investigation as opposed to what was going on.
I mean, the story of Hynek, that alone should convince anybody who's a skeptic to become a believer. When a guy like that changes his mind, and I mean literally his career, when he put together a Center for UFO Studies in Chicago, I mean, that should convince you right then, huh?
Well, in dealing with a lot of the skeptics, and I'm not, this is not all of them, but a lot of them have the mindset there is no alien visitation. Ergo, anything that suggests otherwise must be a hoax, a lie, a delusion, an illusion, or a misrepresentation. There can be no evidence to prove it, no matter what you have. And some of them set the bar incredibly high, and there's something to be said for that. You know, well, we need bits of the UFO. We need an alien body to prove it. But I think that you can look at the evidence that has been gathered, especially when you have multiple chains of evidence and you look at some of the sightings. And going back to Leveland, you had the multiple chains of evidence. You had the witness testimony. You had the interaction with the environment. You had the possibility of a landing trace that would have provided some real good science had anybody bothered with that. But like I said, they were so busy arguing about the trivia of the case that they didn't get down to doing the science of it. And I think if we put together some cases like that, then they're going to be hard pressed to ignore the evidence.
Yeah.
It's just we have not systematically put the cases together.
Let's go to the phones now. James, truck driving in Illinois, east of the Rockies. You're on the air, James. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Great show tonight. Long time listener.
Thank you
for being out there.
We will always.
And, Colonel, thank you for your service, but I've been doing some research on a very amateur level onto the abduction subject that we got. And I was going to question, have you found any kind of profile or any kind of thread that links the individuals that are being abducted together? Is there like a mindset, a philosophy, a belief?
Yes, and it's interesting you bring that up because it is John Mack who actually said that. There's a book by Bryant about the abduction conferences held at MIT, and in that book, Mack says it is interesting that the abductees seem to seek out the researcher who has the same sort of belief that they do. In other words, the cold, calculating, scientific aliens seem, the witnesses for that or the abductees for that seem to gravitate toward Bud Hopkins. And those with a somewhat Eastern philosophy gravitated toward John Mack. And those who were in sort of the hybrid situation and that sort of thing sort of gravitated toward David Jacobs. So it was something that actually Mack observed and had said a number of times that there was that sort of aligning of abduction researchers with the abductees who had a similar experience or a similar philosophy.
The work of some of the skeptics who are out there, who some have passed on now, of course, are they still there? Are there still skeptics in this field, Kevin?
Oh, absolutely. And they are... You know, with Philip Klass, at least he made the attempt to study the the cases, even though oftentimes he went off on tangents right. and his explanations made no sense.
And I think he already knew the answer to what he was going to say, but at least he tried, huh?
Yeah, and if you got him in a discussion one-on-one, not in front of an audience or on a TV program or a radio program, he was much more cordial and would listen to what you had to say and discuss the ideas rationally and intelligently. But when you got into the environment where there was an audience, then his attitude sort of changed. Well, there's nothing to all of this stuff. And I was on Larry King's show, and Philip talking about Roswell, and Philip Klass was there. And the one thing he was pontificating about some of the problems with the Roswell case, and I said, Larry, ask him how many of the Roswell witnesses he's talked to. And I thought he said one, but actually what he said was none. And I thought, well, there you go.
Yeah.
You know, have you not talked to witnesses? Since that after that point, he did talk to the witnesses and things like that. But at that point, he was there with the anti-UFO attitude without having actually talked to any of the people who were involved in this sort of thing and looking at the limited documentation that was available.
Larry was great for the UFO community, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. We had a great deal of fun when he took us all out to Area 51 and broadcast from the Area 51.
Oh, I remember that.
And Stan Friedman was there as well. So it was a good time.
I think Art was there too, wasn't he?
Who was?
I think Bell was there too, wasn't he?
I think John Greer.
I thought
was
Bell
there.
Was there. If he didn't say too much, but he was there. I'm pretty sure he was wearing like a camel-looking jacket.
I have to go look at the picture. Actually, I have on DVD. I actually have that.
I mean, it was done outside, photo. Right?
Yes, we were outside.
I remember
the stage
that.
And in the sunset, and it was really kind of fun.
Yeah, I remember that. Okay, next up, let's go to Gary truck driving. This time he's in Montana. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Listen, I've been listening to you for a couple of decades, and I've never called in before, but I felt compelled. I have a couple of quick things to say, and then a big question.
Sure.
About your guests and relationships to some of the people he's interviewed in multiple personality disorder.
Okay.
But first, let me say that I wasn't going to say this until I listened to you the last 20 minutes, but my brother-in-law, an aerospace engineer, a metallurgist specialist. I've never said anything to anybody about this story he's told me before. Very credible individual. You may know who he is. I'll tell you his name in a minute. He has invented many, many aerospace technology items, such as the explosive bolt that they used to hold down the Saturn rockets prior to the liftoff from the Cape. He is credited with inventing all kinds of fasteners, like every fastener used on any aircraft today is called an eddy bolt. I don't know if either one of you gentlemen have ever heard of that, but it was named after him because it can be fastened by one person, and it's used to put all the skin on all aircraft. He was also, and I say this because I'm trying to develop his credibility, he was also the general contractor on the stealth bomber.
Great,
his name was
great
Edgar Stenfel. He has since passed. He was in the Air Force, and he died of cancer 6 years ago.
Gary, hold on right there. We are at the break. I don't want to lose you, so we're going to come right back to you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, yep, the physicist Ronald Mallett joins us as we talk about time travel. Can it happen? That'll be part of our Coast to Coast show. And welcome back to Coast, Kevin Randall with us. Let's go back to Gary truck driving out there in Montana. Hey, Gary, pick it up. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks, George. And before I continue, let me tell you, I listen to a lot of radio shows while I'm driving, and you are the most gracious radio host there is out there or ever has been.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you.
So, let me second that while we got Gary there. I second that.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, Kevin, I agree with you 110%. So my brother-in-law, reason I mention all these things is to give him a little credibility because he's a very, very credible man. I used to talk to him all the time about UFOs and about space travel and so forth, because he is an aerospace engineer and he knew a lot about space travel and so forth. Every time I ever asked him about UFOs and stuff, he'd always just smile and just say, well, that's a topic I really don't want to talk about. Until about 7 years ago. I didn't know at the time, but he knew he was going to die. And I went over to visit him when he got real, started becoming very, very ill. And I sat down with him like I used to a lot of times, and we started talking. One thing led to another, and he looked at me and said, are you ever going to ask me about UFOs again? And I said, yeah, I'll ask you right now. What do you believe in them? What do you know about them? So we talked quite a bit. Anyway, long story as short as possible, because I know your show. He was at Roswell. He was put in a Jeep with four other gentlemen that he didn't know, but while they were driving through the desert, bumping over whatever, and headed to a particular site where there was a tremendous number of military people and lights and all kinds of things going on, they struck up conversations and realized that they were all engineers of some sort or another. Long story short, he told me in a very, very, it was about a 4.5 hour conversation, where he was very, very honest, I believe, and very truthful, and everything he said was very heartfelt. He told me that, bottom line, when he returned to a big hangar in the state of Arizona at Area 51, which became Area 51, I guess, he carried in his lap for 35 minutes a piece of metal that he had never seen before, that had a texture to it that he'd never seen before, and it had pliability to it that he'd never seen in a metal before. He didn't himself get to analyze it like he thought he was going to be able to do, but he told me that there was a crash site, that they were all kept apart from one another, different groups of people were kept apart from one another during the process of recovery. He wasn't really sure exactly what was going on, but, you know, he's an engineer, he's a bright guy. He was able to pretty much put a lot of things together by the time the night was over and realized that they were probably at a UFO crash site. And then especially when he was walking around out there and they found this piece of metal, they immediately threw him back in a Jeep and drove him to a special location and declassified, not declassified him, but whatever you call it, I don't know that military terms about what they did, but they talked to them. They split that whole group of four guys up. They sent them all over the country. They made them sign documentation that said they would never, ever talk about what they did, what they saw, what they heard, or anything else. And the only reason I think he ever told me about this, and I asked him, I said, did you think you were holding on to an alien piece of metalwork? And he said, absolutely, there's no question in my mind about it. And, I mean, this guy couldn't have been any more credible of an individual that I've ever known in my entire life. Like I said, an aerospace engineer for over 50 years, invented many, many things, general contractor on the stealth bomber. He wasn't a quack. There's no question about that. He's a very intelligent man. And that was the one and only time he ever told me, after 25 years of asking him about UFOs and stuff. He was on his deathbed. He knew it. I didn't. But he knew he was going to go, and he felt like he needed to tell somebody. And when he was done telling me this story for 4.5 hours, he told me that, you probably think I'm crazy. And I said, no, not at all. And he said, but I'm telling you because I'm not going to be here much longer, and I wanted you to know.
Wow.
And I was just taken aback, just absolutely, because there couldn't have been a more grounded, more scientific, more pragmatic person in the world than this gentleman, Edgar Stentzel. He was a fantastic individual, and he added a tremendous amount in little ways to the space program and to air travel and so forth. And again, the most used fastener in the aerospace industry for the last 20 years is named after him.
Gary, you are well worth keeping over for. That's a great story, Kevin.
That's an amazing story.
And you know, a deathbed confession has got to be truth. I'm pretty convinced that nearly everybody on their deathbed will tell you the truth before they go.
Can't see anybody. There's no point in making up a story at that.
No.
At that time. And it's something that the guy had kept quiet for years and years and years, and finally, I guess, felt that he would be, it would be safe for him to just mention this to his relatives.
His dear ones. That's right. Gary, thank you for sharing that with us. I really appreciate it. We've got a Skype caller now. Dusty is in Paola, Kansas. Hey, Dusty, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
Sure thing.
First time caller. Yeah, I can't believe I got on. So I'll be brief. George, Kevin, huge fans of you both.
Thank you, sir.
And Kevin, I just want to say I'm a huge fan of your Project Blue Book Exposed.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I, as I told the man who I talked to before I got on here.
Tommy.
He was a heck of a nice guy. As I told him, I've literally bought at least a dozen copies of Project Blue Book Exposed because I keep lending them out and I never get them back. I think it's a great primer for people who are interested in that or skeptical. And it's a great book, and I'm going to keep buying copies of it because so far, with the exception of one person, everyone's loved it, and I've, like I said, never get it back. And that leads me to my question. I recently had a very good friend of mine read it, and he told me that regarding – I asked him, you know, why do you think they made up all these weird explanations for these UFO sightings and all these events? And he told me that he believed that it was a generational thing, and that since they couldn't explain them, these sightings and reports, that they had to make up something. And he did not believe that the government was actually hiding anything. And I was curious as to what – I didn't know what to say, and I was curious what you thought about that, if you've gotten that a lot.
If you take a look at the government UFO files – it kind of outlines or lays out how this whole thing developed. And I think if you look at the Foo Fighters, for example, during World War II, the investigation was done under a great deal of secrecy simply because they didn't want the enemy to know what we were concerned about.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't know what they were. We thought they were enemy weapons, but we were trying to keep the information secret. When you get to the ghost rockets, it seemed to have been creating something of a panic in Scandinavia and then Northern Europe. And the Swedish government decided, I think the Finnish government started first, but the Swedish government decided they were going to tell the press stop printing these stories so that they could investigate them without worrying about that. When you get to the United States, I think in after the Arnold sighting, they're extremely concerned about it, what it is. They're trying to figure it out. They're doing all of this, but it suddenly dawns on them, this stuff has been going on for years, and there's been no invasion, there's been no problems, there's no hostile, apparently no hostile intent, so I think they backed off a little bit. But if you take a look at the history, after Roosevelt's reign ended in 1953, you can see that they are appointing officers who are not just neutral on the subject, they're anti-UFO. And you can see from the regulations, they say in the regulations, for example, if the sighting is unidentified, you are not allowed to release information. If you can put an explanation on it, if there's an explanation, well, then you can tell the public what it was. And it became a public relations mission to explain UFOs as opposed to investigate them. And you can see that transition as you go back and you read the Project Blue Book files and you read the documentation. So it's clear that they were hiding something in the files, and we can see that cases disappeared from the files, and one of them is from April of 1947, just prior to Arnold's sighting, with weather forecasters, weathermen in Richmond, Virginia. It's a wonderful file. It's referenced in the Project Grudge final report, but there's no case file and no mention of it anywhere. So you can see the files have been sanitized. There's no mention of Roswell in the Project Blue Book files, and it doesn't really matter what you think Roswell was, unless, of course, it was alien and it was top secret because they couldn't put it in the Blue Book files. The only reference I can find is in another case And there's a newspaper clipping with that case that says, with a single paragraph, says the public affairs officer received a blistering rebuke for reporting that they had found a flying saucer. So that's the only mention in the Project Blue Book files, and the question is, why isn't there nothing else? There's all kinds of UFO crash cases listed in the Blue Book files, but they all have a mundane explanation. So the fact that it was a crash case doesn't mean anything, unless, of course, it was something much more important than those cases that they had. So there's clear evidence from the Project Blue Book files and other government documentation. There was secrecy going on, and they were lying to the public. There was Project Moondust, which was kind of followed on after, actually began in 1957, which had a UFO component. And a United States senator wrote to the Air Force and said, you want to know something about Moondust. And the Air Force wrote back and said, that's never such a project, didn't exist. And when documentation from the State Department and the Air Force was given to them to say, yeah, well, here's Moondust, they said, yeah, it existed, we just never used it. That also is a blatant lie. So we can demonstrate through the documentation that there was a component to the UFO investigation that was secret, and it was concealed.
When I was a little boy, my father used to watch Science Fiction Theater with me.
Oh, I love that show.
The very first episode.
You can see it on YouTube.
Yep, 1955, the first episode was traveling at three times the speed of sound. A test pilot bails out of his plane because he saw another craft about to collide with his. The very first one.
They did a number of UFO-oriented
they sure did.
Stories on there. The one that I remembered as a kid seeing is the guy in a Menzel-like attitude had created the Lubbock light. Lubbock lights bouncing a light off a layer of acetone, and I forget what the other chemical was, to create that sort of an inversion to make it look like a UFO. And that was the one I remembered. I actually found it on YouTube. Almost all the science fiction theater episodes are on YouTube for those of you who want to see those.
They were great shows. Great shows.
Oh, they were wonderful. Wonderful.
I'll always remember my dad, you know, putting me on the couch next day and watching it. Heck, I was 5 years old when it started. I mean, that's a long time ago.
I would have been 6 years old when it started then.
Kevin, we're getting...
Well, you know, we share a birthday, and I'm exactly a year
That's
older.
That's right,
than you.
June 4th.
So, yes.
Let's go to Joseph in Fresno, California. Joseph, thanks for calling. You are with us.
Thank you, George. I really love your show. I've been listening to you now for too long, but...
Thank you, Joseph.
Listen, I start working nights, and I really enjoy your show anyway. I want to say that I'm an ex-military from El Salvador.
Okay.
Civil War. And one time they put me to protect this area. We were going to capture a guerrilla commander in this place. And then, and I still seen, my point is that I'm a believer because I've seen this orange disc flying in the distance, making like a heart shape, you know, and then suddenly they all disappeared. One of them just flies like towards me and he passes by. He stops at a distance, like a couple of trees up. Or I don't know how tall that could be, but then it started just looking at me. I just looked at it and I said, "This is not any equipment that we have, you know." And the thing is that I moved to California, and here in Fresno, I seen this thing twice again. I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I see the same shape of these things. And not that long ago, I step out and I see this right in front of my house. I see this thing just putting up the same, it's like a sun right there, an orange disc just looking at me.
And when you saw this, what did you think it was?
I know it's not an airplane. It's not something that it's not a machine. I know the speed is so it's extreme speed. It's like it just moves extremely fast. I run inside, try to get my phone so I could take a video, and I try to just videotape it. And I was getting my phone. It started moving towards the back of my house. I run to the other side, but behind my house, as soon as I could get it. And when I'm ready to take a video, get it with my phone, and he just take off like a flash, just disappears.
Well, there are many, many sightings. Only a few minutes left here, Kevin. People are still seeing strange things that they can't explain. I guess some of them could be drones, but there's still something out there, Kevin.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the things we have to work through is the personal belief structure, and that was what my PhD dissertation was on, is how belief structure influences the identification of an ambiguous stimuli. And people who accept alien visitation often interpret what would be a natural phenomenon as something alien. But there's still an awfully lot of good sightings going on. They just are not as robust as they were, you know, in the past. And I'm wondering if we're going to get another good wave of sightings where we'll get the same kind of incredible reports. Is it the fault of the investigators not gathering the proper information or getting the information nailed down? I'm not sure what's going on, but there's certainly been a dip in the quality of the sightings. But we still get some good ones like Stephenville, Texas, and O'Hare.
That's
and that
right.
Sort of thing.
Phoenix, the Phoenix Lights. That was a great
Phoenix
one.
Lights, yes, absolutely.
Kevin, thanks again, Lieutenant Colonel. Appreciate that. Sorry for taking a stripe away from you, but we gave it back.
Oh, it was more than one.
You got it. Take care. Kevin Randall, his books, by the way, just a few of them, The Government UFO Files, Reflections of a UFO Investigator, Crash When UFOs Fall from the Sky. He's one of the world's top-notch UFO investigators, Kevin Randall. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borlson, George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.